You're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K24AL Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden on the Farm.
The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of KKCR, its board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Paul and Robin, and on today's show, we'll appreciate the ease, taste, and nutrition of growing your own microgreens. Get growing well with brassicas and consider the merits and practice of crop rotation. Hey, Robin.
Hi, Paul.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good to be
Thank
back
you very
with
much.
You. Excited for the show today.
Great to be back in the garden.
Indeed it is. And I must say that we're still flying high after a super successful membership drive over the last 10 days of last week and the week previous to that. We did have one In the Garden on the Farm show, and we want to say we're so grateful to our listeners for donating $1,500 during our show. Very proud of our community of gardeners and farmers supporting sustainable agriculture and this venue for discussion. So thank you everybody who contributed. And all told, we raised over $50,000 for the station to keep all of the great programming going here. So mahalo, mahalo.
Yeah, we were just blown away. Thank you so much, Ohana.
So as we do every week, we're going to start off by casting our sight to the heavens above that have actually a very strong influence on the plants and animals and the whole ecosystem that we lovingly manage as gardeners and farmers here on Kauai and in the Hawaiian Islands. Starting with the Hawaiian moon, we're in the second phase or anahulu of the moon's monthly cycle. Poi poi, which means rounding or full, we've entered since yesterday. And today's moon is Mohalu. And Mohalu rises on Kauai at 3:27 p.m. this afternoon. She'll reach her transit at 9:49 p.m. and sets at 4:15 a.m. tomorrow morning. 86% of the moon's face is illuminated as she shines her light down on us today. Mohalu is the 12th day of the month and the first of the ancient Kane taboo, when planting was not allowed during this time period. Fortunately for us, though, because it is such a productive time, we are encouraged to plant, and it is preferred for planting flowers because it was believed that flowers would be round and perfect like the moon on this night. Hmm. And that information from the Pukui Hawaiian Dictionary. Mohalu also means loose, slack, at ease, unrestrained, at liberty, and comfortable. Mm. Characters that we should always be when we're in the garden is just, you know, feeling that sense of potential and ease rather than the stress of things that might be going wrong in the garden. It also means to open, unfold as flowers. We've got the full moon coming up on Sunday, this November 17th at 5:17 a.m. That moon, the Hawaiian name is Hoku, rises at 5:34 p.m. on Saturday, and she reaches the highest point in the sky, which again is the transit, at 15 minutes after midnight. Mm. So you can imagine how we're all going to be awake to some extent or another if the clouds have parted and that powerful moon energy is going to be shining down on us.
Mm. And asking our plant roots to reach up towards it. Be a particularly good night to fertilize, seems like.
Yes.
Well, in the biodynamic look at things, today and tomorrow, the moon's in Pisces, a water sign, making it a great time to work with our leafy plants. Friday and Saturday, the moon will be in Aries, a fire sign, which will be a good time for us to work with our fruiting plants. And Sunday through Tuesday, full moon in Taurus, an earth sign, making it a great time for root plants. So also the roots here are illuminated on yet another level during that full moon, which really makes me think I probably will do some fertilizing that day. Look for Venus and Mercury in the western sky early in the evening right now, and Jupiter all night long. It'll be rising not too long after sunset, and Jupiter will make its slow transit across the sky, the whole sky, all night for the rest of the month, which is pretty fun to look at.
And what about this comet that we've been hearing about?
Oh, right? News to me. Tell me about it. What about the comet?
Oh, I can't tell you a thing. I bet we're going to get a call here coming up soon. But a comet that is going to be the brightest object in the sky other than the moon is coming soon. And the tail will be visible. And I can't tell you too much more than that.
Excellent.
So at any rate, whether or not it will have influences on the plants, I guess we'll just have to observe and see.
Yeah, we'll just keep praying that it doesn't land, I suppose.
Indeed. Pass alongside, please.
Absolutely, because we want to do some good growing. And so we are going to, at this point, continue on our brassica talk. As you know, by listening, we like to do kind of a three-part series on a plant family. First, all our relations, which just describes simply the relationships between different sort of common plants that we know, and sometimes we like to go out there into some less common plants too. But today we're going to talk about how to grow your brassicas really well, and I think it's a perfect thing to talk about right now. This time of year really is the best time of year for brassicas, and I'll get to why in just a little bit. May I?
Please.
Go on a little bit.
Okay. Wax on.
Excellent. Well, firstly, brassicas include, as you remember from our conversation with Lisa a few weeks ago, broccolis, cabbages, turnips, radishes, cauliflowers, kales, our ever-beloved kales of all kinds. And what they really, really like is rich, fertile soil. Mm. They want the best of the best, essentially, and they certainly, in my garden at least, get it because I do adore them so much. They're heavy feeders, so you want to start out with a really rich soil, and you may need to look at fertilizing them monthly with a light dose of something. A liquid like a compost tea or light fish emulsion can suffice, but in order to keep those leaves nice and big, particularly on our kale plants, you have to keep feeding them nitrogen pretty much. Uh-huh. They will exhaust the soil pretty quickly. The pH of the soil between 6 and 7 is their preference. And they like plenty of spacing. And this is something we touched on when we had Lisa on the show with us from One Song. And I wanted to talk a little bit more in depth about it because this is just a really practical, important practical step in growing good brassicas, and it's really about proper harvesting. Starting with spacing, is we don't want to squeeze the plants in so tight that their leaves are kind of getting tangled in with one another. They like to have their space. And when we harvest the plants, we want to actually break the leaf cleanly from the trunk with kind of one very
A deft motion.
Yeah, deft motion, but a conscious motion. Because if we take a pruner or scissors or a knife and we cut the stem just next to the trunk of the plant, what happens is that little piece of stem will start to rot, as it would, and then it can transfer rot to the trunk. Right. And when we make this really nice, clean break, I see that it keeps the kales much healthier for much longer, mm-hmm. and you'll get a longer lifespan. Once you start to see mushy brown spots on the trunk of the kale, really, it's showing you it's got a rot, and depending on the weather and the water and how we treat it, that can spread really quickly and take the plant down.
And unlike a woody shrub where if you saw that kind of a problem, you might be able to bring it back into a state of wholeness once it's got that kind of thing. With an herbaceous plant like that, it's probably too late to get it back from having like a dead spot on it.
Yeah, exactly. Brassica trunks, they actually, I can't tell if they're hollow or they're solid. Some seem hollow and some seem more solid. It's really hard to guess, but the way I've learned most of what I've learned about the brassicas is by making a lot of mistakes. and doing it wrong, pretty much. And then the plant sort of tells you, and you know, you wanna listen to the plant and what it has to say to you. So when you make a mistake once, you don't wanna necessarily make that mistake again. So cabbages and cauliflowers are generally kind of a once-and-done vegetable in the family. So once the head of cauliflower or the head of cabbage is ready to be harvested, you're pretty much taking out the whole plant. So the harvesting isn't really as much of an issue there because we're not generally harvesting much off the plant until the actual produce is ready. Collards are basically non-heading cabbages. So those are cabbage leaves. They're quite delicious. They like hot and cold weather, and they're extremely versatile green. And when you get to a plant like collard, which it can be very long-lived in the garden, you really do want to pay attention to how you harvest the leaves, because you'll shorten the lifespan of the plant greatly if you introduce some kind of rot. Now, generally, the cabbages and broccolis and stuff we're growing are basically ready to go in about 65 to 80 days or so. It's really pretty remarkable. I mean, that's just a little over 2 months of growing, and you've got a broccoli or a cauliflower to harvest. It's pretty fantastic.
How have you enjoyed growing that Piricaba
broccoli? Piricaba has been very nice. I'm just starting to harvest from it right now. Yeah. And actually, I like that you asked me that, because that's where I was heading. Is apart from the kales, another plant that we can harvest over the long term is broccoli. But that is actually provided that we harvest it properly. Mm. And I've learned a little trick that I kind of wanted to share with everyone, because it really has made a difference. I've seen it visibly with my own eyes many times, and it'll give you a multi-harvest. The largest and the first main head is huge and beautiful, and when that plant, that part of the plant's ready to harvest, the timing of harvest and the manner in which you harvest it are very important to how long the plant's going to live. And I have learned very specifically that using biodynamic calendar and harvesting my first head of broccoli on basically an error day or a fire day, so a flower day or a fruit day, the moon is in an air sign or a fire sign, tends to be the best time. And when I cut that main head off, I don't cut it straight across. I actually cut it at a diagonal, mm-hmm. so that water can't sit on the cut and eventually move down and rot into the plant.
Right.
Also, when I've harvested my first perfect head of broccoli on a wetter day, say a water sign day or an earth sign day, instantly the plant starts to rot from the middle. And that's typically when I see that it's hollow after I cut it. Versus when I cut it on fruit days or flower days, it actually looks solid and it will heal over very nicely.
Incredible. So you're observing that the physical structure of the plant is in flux depending on the cosmic forces at play.
Sure. It's what it looks like to me, the lunar mostly. And so I just want to remind people that if you cut that first head of broccoli off well, you will harvest broccolettes off of that same plant for months and months and months. If it doesn't go so well and you get some rot upon that first cutting, you maybe have a month of side shoots. You're really cutting down the longevity of the plant with not harvesting it properly. So having said that, I'll just continue on to the end of my research here. I encourage people to look at planting in succession instead of planting a whole lot of something all at one time. And particularly with the broccolis and the cauliflowers and the cabbages, mm-hmm. I think it's best to plant about 3 of them every 3 weeks if you have the space to do so, because you kind of can keep this nice rotating harvest. And really, we can grow those wonderful European vegetables, cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, from about November through March. And we can grow the heck out of them during that amount of time if you time out your plantings really nicely.
Where does kohlrabi fit into that? Is that something that really prefers this time of year as well? Can you grow them all the way through the year?
Absolutely, no. They all, and that's actually the last thing that I wanted to really wrap up with, is we can do everything right, but if we get a heat wave, the brassicas just don't love it. The cool weather is really imperative for them. They really prefer to grow when it's nice, cool nights, and they just really perform so much better. So,
and the flavor is supposedly better with kales and other kinds of brassicas when they get even a frost on them, yeah?
That's right, that sweetens them, which we won't get here, but it kind of works out perfectly because technically broccolis and cauliflowers are flowers. Now that we're hitting the end of the year, we're heading towards the winter solstice, the days are getting shorter, plants want to flower. So we're putting in the perfect plant at the perfect time.
Right.
And so really that's the key, is we can grow them very successfully if we grow them at the right time. Their rhythms just fit so nicely into our fall and winter gardens here. It's just lovely.
Yeah. So this is In the Garden on the Farm with your hosts, Paul, and Robin has been illuminating us on growing well with brassicas. Now, as it relates to seeds, I know that brassicas are ones that the gardeners are generally starting in the nursery as opposed to direct seeding, at least with some of them. Is it true that even the rooted crops, I suppose daikon, that's in brassica, and that would be a direct seed plant?
That's right. Turnips also.
How do you make the decision there, whether you're direct seeding or starting in flats?
Generally, my line that I draw is if it's a root plant, I direct seed it. Mm-hmm. I feel they'd rather be direct into the earth right away when that first root tip comes out. It doesn't feel any boundaries on itself at all. And that's if we're going to grow them out. But one very important factor to that is to thin our directly seeded plants. If we leave things too tight, there's too many falling leaves in there rotting away. And one thing that brassicas really do not like, apart from heat waves, is rotting brassica leaves.
Right.
So in general, we don't groom up our plants until they start to yellow their leaves and the leaves fall off naturally. And at that point, please don't leave your dead brassica leaves around your brassicas. Do remove them to a compost pile. But brassica roots already leave some exudates in the soil that are not great for brassicas to begin with, and then falling brassica leaves are just not beneficial to the plants. So I draw the line with root crops, basically, to answer your question.
Yes, and because you have so much experience sprouting seeds, how do you find that the brassica family behaves different, or you treat the seed in a different way when you sow flats or anything?
No, actually, apart from the fact that they're all little perfect circles and they all want to dive in out of the seed pack at the same exact moment,
yes.
I haven't found that I treat them differently, although I am aware that there's a pest problem, which we'll talk about next week, that is seed-borne in brassicas, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to really choose our seed sources well, and make sure we're buying seeds from people we feel really good about and the plants we really loved.
Yes. Well, I would say that's a perfect segue to introduce our in-studio guest. We're delighted to be joined by Susan Alima Fryer. Alima began her love affair with gardening in Vermont in 1973. She moved on to becoming a Waldorf teacher and as a farmer on the Big Island. Alima moved to Kauai in 2012, where she began teaching and sharing her desire for everyone to grow more of their own food. And her concern over lack of awareness of the importance of nutrition and lack of fresh food for inner city teens that she worked with began motivating her to learn about small ways to grow fresh food. And microgreens are certainly small, but packed with nutrition, flavor, and a great choice for many gardeners. There's a new book that Alima is offering to us, Growing Microgreens Step by Step, available in print format and a variety of electronic formats as well. So I want to welcome you to the show, Alima.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I just love KKCR and all that you do and all that you share for the community. You're such wonderful supports in and out of the studio. It's been a treat being on Kauai and sharing with people at the farmers market, and just really great the response and seeing how people have taken to growing their own greens. And you can grow these microgreens anywhere on the island, but there's some places they do like better and some weather patterns. Listening to Robin made me think about what the brassicas, which are my kind of no-fail crop for the starters, for the beginners. Mm-hmm. They just love the fresh air, good soil, water, and light at the right time. And you can't go wrong.
Right on. And what beautiful colors, too. I was looking at some of the pictures from your book and the purple stems on some of these. I think kohlrabi was even one of the
purple
ones.
Purple kohlrabi, yes. And red cabbage are amazing.
Yep.
And, the colors and the just wonderful little piquant flavor. It's just a little bit more zippy than broccoli and the kale. It's great.
Can you tell us and our listeners, how did you get bit by the bug of microgreens of all the different ways? I mean, we have a lot of container growers who grow their vegetables in a small area, but microgreens, it seems, a niche that not too many people fall into.
Right. When I lived in Taos, New Mexico, the soil was really poor. I was living out on the mesa, and it was just really frustrating. And I tried growing in pots, and then, of course, winter came. And there was still good light, but it was below freezing. So I had been thinking about ways I could grow. I had sprouted before. And I decided to try growing sunflowers and shoot peas. And I couldn't believe it. I was just getting huge crops very easily in about a week's time. And they didn't have problem. It was probably 65 in the house. No problem. They were very happy. So that caught me. And then I kept watching all the other farmers, at the farmer's market with their microgreens and with their large crops. And I just thought, well, what can I take anywhere? I was very interested in aquaponics, but I didn't see myself being somewhat of a gypsy, setting up a system and then having to transport it. So microgreens seemed to be the next logical step.
Yeah. And what is it, the difference between just growing sprouts and then growing microgreens? What happens to the plant? Obviously, it gets bigger, but is there a nutritional change? And how, if for people who grow sprouts, explain to us, which I do, explain to us why take the jump to microgreens?
Well, microgreens are the youngest plant, actually. With sprouts, you've got a seed that has sprouted but has not fully germinated. Once it's in the soil, and Robin maybe can correct me on this, but in the soil, it's a whole nother world. I think once you grow them, you'll see. It's kind of like Robin with all her babies that start out and they're in the soil, and when they come up, it's just very different. And if you've eaten both, you'll see the difference too. I did bring some samples for you all.
Oh, good.
I may bring them in just after we finish talking.
Fantastic.
But I wanted you to see what the difference is in the taste, because it's so easy. I think that's one thing. And I find some vegetables or plants easier to grow in as microgreens than I do in the soil, in the ground. And sometimes I have extra, and then they end up in the garden. But I think it was just feeling that I would get more nutrition. From what I've read, most of the microgreens have 30 to 35% protein. But the variety of minerals and vitamins is amazing. I have not researched sprouts as well, but I will be looking at that. And I have a blog, GaiasCreations.com, and I'll put that on there because I'm curious too.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we were just talking before the show started about the sun requirements for the microgreens. As a nursery person, I need direct sun, lots of it. That's how I prefer to grow them up. But I can see how in a microgreen situation that might be a little overbearing for the plants. So
yeah.
I wondered how you were able to develop just the perfect lighting for your microgreens.
You don't ever have the perfect lighting. It's like you, Robin. You experiment and you learn by trial and error. I've grown microgreens in Kapaha, kind of towards Kapahi. I've grown them in Wailua, and I've grown them in Waineha, as far as on this island. And each place is very different. Where I am in Wailua right now is not, the air doesn't move enough. So they're not as happy. The growth is not quite the same. And I think the keys are just having good air movement, and if you have them inside and it's not enough, just put a little fan on. you know. Open the window for us out here. We can do that. On the mainland, maybe a fan. Though I never needed a fan in Taos. I mean, it just felt like the air moved. Plus, we did have a humidifier. It was so dry. So that may have helped. Mm-hmm. But it's really experimenting. I don't think there's any right place. The one thing you want to be careful of is that you don't dry out your plants. If your soil is too wet or your soil is too dry, you've got a problem, as any farmer does. So it's a balancing act. And with microgreens, it's small enough that you can always do it. So you just check them morning and night. How are they doing? And in the beginning, I actually keep them covered, either have a dome of some type on top of them until they begin to come up above the soil. Because they're usually sprouted seeds. A few of them you don't sprout, but it's all in the book or in my class.
Yeah.
Yeah, so tell us a little more about your book.
Please. Well, the book is very basic. It's a real how-to step-by-step because I've had one person say or more in class say, pretend I'm a kindergartner. So to a certain extent, I give people the how-to of different families or different types that I put together, and then I summarize it. And try to give people a picture, too, of some of the stages, what to expect, what are root hairs as opposed to mold, what do you need to look for, what are the keys in keeping it simple. And that's what I try to do. Keep it simple, keep it basic, and divide it up into the brassicas, which are I put first because I think they're easiest, and then sunflower and shoot peas are pretty similar. Then I do the ones that are mucilaginous, which means they would be like gum if you soak them, so you don't soak them. And then a few others that are fun and interesting, like popcorn.
Mm. That was surprising to me.
Yeah.
I know so many grasses are edible, but grazing on a field of young corn sprouts wasn't the first thing that had occurred
right.
to me. But
well, shoots, when you plant them and you see the way the birds come after them in the field and go to town on those sprouts, I guess hadn't occurred to me either. But yeah.
The idea of eating sunflowers also, it's like, whoa, that seems like not too palatable when you see the adult plant. But, of course, when they're mm-hmm. young, they're just absolutely tender and delicious and nutritious.
Yeah,
and
so I'm curious, Alima, when is the ideal harvest time? I know we have cotyledons. We have the first two leaves that come out. And do you wait for the true leaves?
With the sunflowers, you can't wait for the true leaves. With the sunflowers, they start getting tough if you wait for the true leaves. With everybody else, you can pretty much do, you can tell by the size, by how they look. I don't wait for any second growth intentionally. Usually I don't have time, but what I've seen recently is as I give the brassicas more room, they love to get a bigger leaf, a fuller leaf, not necessarily growing to the next stage, but a fuller leaf, and I just find it's more interesting to have a fuller leaf.
So that means that you actually seed the trays a little more sparsely, so that each sprout has more room in between them? Did I understand correctly?
Without placing them one by one.
Sure.
Because you go crazy, particularly with the smaller seeds. I try to scatter them, and then if they seem too close or they're on top of each other, except for sunflowers, which I let be on top of each other somewhat, everybody else, I try to give a little room, at least not be on top of each other. You kind of get a feel for it. I mean, I always think of the farmer just scattering the seeds. Well, these have been sprouted, and they scatter somewhat, but it's not like a dry seed. So I try to give them just a little bit of room between each one, and I can see the difference in each crop when I do and when I don't.
Well, it's just really interesting to me because the same goes for kales when you plant them out. The leaves can never get very big if they're too close together, no matter how much food is in there. They really do need that root space to be able to reach out, and then their leaves can mimic it.
Yeah, all the brassicas seem to reflect that. I've tried growing them in different methods, and they just need that extra bit of room. Otherwise, you'll see them stunted and small, and they just can't get enough air and enough soil to really do what's possible. And with the cost of seeds, you don't want to do that. I mean, when you buy, the nice thing is when you buy in quantity from a good organic farm or supplier, you can get a better price. There's no question. I encourage people to co-op, too, because of shipping to Hawaii. But you really can get a decent price. for seeds and get a really good quality seed, which is essential.
Essential, absolutely.
We're speaking with Alima Fryer. She's the author of a new book released just this year, Growing Microgreens Step by Step. And Alima is also going to be offering a class coming up this weekend on growing microgreens.
On Sunday at 12:30, I'm offering my final class on the island.
For now. Let's not say
for
forever.
Not forever, not until we come back. But it will. If you're interested, please give me a call because I do sprout the seeds for the starter class. Mm-hmm. And it's 482-4926. I would love to have a few more people come. If not, look at my book online. And is the fundraiser still going on?
No, it's not. But thank you so much for offering some of the copies during our segment last week.
Well, I still say if people, because of this show, respond to me and they want to make a donation to the station, I would like to donate a book.
Excellent.
Thank you so much, Alima.
So tell us where is the class located and what time is it?
It's going to be at 12:30 on Sunday.
Yes.
And it will be on, I'm not going to say location, I'm going to say call.
Okay.
Because
part of the island, how about that?
It'll be in Wailua Homesteads.
Okay, very good.
So it'll be really easy to find, but I'm waiting to see how many people I have.
Besides the telephone, Alima, do you want to give out contact information, such as your email or any other way to reach you?
Yeah. I'll give you my email, which is Gaia's Creations, which is GAIAS Creations, plural, at live.com. And I have a blog also, GaiasCreations.com, where I give suggestions to people and answer questions.
Excellent.
Is this your first book?
Yes. It's my first book of this type. I used to own an inn for 9 years, mm-hmm. and I had 2 little cookbooks.
Oh, nice.
But a very different world.
Well, we should mention, too, that your Growing Microgreens step-by-step book has recipes in it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Where
yeah.
Once you've grown these things, sure, they're great out of hand, but let's get creative and put them in some delicious recipes, too.
In smoothies and salads. I actually was recommended I have more and more greens, and I thought, oh, how else am I going to eat them? So I make different soups each week, and at the end of making the soup, I puree them microgreens into it, and some of them like sunflower and shoot peas I put on top. So there are all kinds of ways that you can do something with it. I didn't have enough big kale for my juice the other day, so I put it through and I figured out how to make it work with the juicer and put the kale microgreens through and get really some effective juicing as part of my drink.
Yeah, excellent.
Well, it's obvious that growing microgreens can be a great option for people who don't have even a backyard. They've got a windowsill, they've got a patio or a lanai. But it's also a really strong possibility for commercial growers. Our friend Aroshan was speaking with somebody growing microgreens on Kauai and said they get $100 a pound for them. So I'm wondering if you can comment on your own experiences selling microgreens.
I grew them commercially for one of the hotels, and I would get, I think it was $8 an ounce for the really good, really good microgreens.
Wow, nice.
And at the market, but I mean, I only had a small job, but it's very time consuming because you have to be willing to clean them thoroughly, wash them thoroughly, and make sure they dry so they hold up for the hotel. Whereas when I sold them at the farmer's market, I would harvest them almost fully at the market, which was great and much more fun for everybody to see them.
Sure.
I also want to just say, this is a great gift. If you don't have much money, buy a small container of the seeds and something to grow, and even a fruit container from the market, which has holes in it, a dome, one of those clamshell containers, and you can give a kid a great gift. Start them out growing something, a little garden. Kids love sunflower seeds. I mean, it's easy to create gifts for family and friends with these.
Yeah. Maybe there'd be a time when at restaurants, a tray of microgreens uncut comes to the table with your salad and you get to cut them yourself. Talk about fresh produce.
That was suggested for a wedding reception, that it would be fun that they would have everybody cut their own microgreens. And I've done something like that. So maybe I will for Thanksgiving.
That'd be super fun. So again, Alima Fryer, thank you for joining us on the show. Where can people pick up your book?
They could call me at 482-4926 or buy it on Amazon, both the hard, the soft cover and the digital Kindle book. I also be happy to offer anybody the PDF if they don't have a Kindle and don't want to buy it. They just call me and we'll work something out.
Great. And where are you headed? Where are you headed now?
Well, when we leave the island,
mm-hmm.
My daughter is expecting her first child, and she's in Colorado, and I think it's good for grandparents to be near.
Indeed.
So in that dry climate, I think they need microgreens.
Perfect.
All right. Thank you, Alima. We'll let people know again about the microgreen class coming up this Sunday at 12:30. It's going to be in the Wailua Homestead area, and you should be in touch with Alima and her number 482-4926.
And I'll be bringing by a copy of the book for the Regenerations Library or the station or whatever.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure
so
to have you. Please stick around and let you know this is In the Garden on the Farm, and you're listening to KKCR, Hanalei K-A-Q-A Kilauea, here with Paul and Robin. And we are excited because we've missed a couple of times on the show to get to Secrets of the Soil Builders. We never want to miss an episode. So we're back at it this week, and we are going to crack into crop rotation. And
yes.
Yeah, so here is a wonderful technique that we either do unconsciously or consciously, but basically crop rotation, I've got a great little description of it. Rotation is the practice of using the natural, biological, and physical properties of crops to benefit the growth, health, and competitive advantage of other crops. In this process, the soil and its life are also benefited. The desired result is a farm or garden which is more productive and to a greater extent self-reliant in resources. That description by Don Kretschmann of the Neon Expert Farmer Rotation Workshop Working Group.
Wow.
And there is actually a great resource if you want to really get deep, deep into this. Crop Rotation on Organic Farms, a Planning Manual, available as a free PDF online. And crop rotation, what's it all about? Well, it's really to produce benefits for us, the gardeners and farmers, in terms of beating disease and pests, breaking those cycles, taking note of the different nutrient needs of different crops and planning wisely. It can improve soil tilth, especially when cover crops are grown and incorporated into the soil as part of a crop rotation program, thereby reducing erosion. And it's also going to encourage us to not sort of get stuck in a rut and always be growing those mainstay, like we love kale, but we can maybe sort of get into a place where we're kind of always growing the go-to. If we're thinking about crop rotation, it compels us to go through the different plant families and try our hand at all the different wonderful vegetables we can grow on our garden and farm. So what do you think, Robin? What's your experience with crop rotation?
Well, you know, a lot of what I've gotten a chance to read has been geared towards larger scale farms. And because I'm not a large scale farmer and I have a fairly small-ish backyard garden, it gets a little trickier to try to really look at crop rotation in such a small space, and particularly for people who I know are out there gardening with, say, one raised bed or small raised bed or things like that. And what I do is, of course, I'm so smitten with Maria Thun's research that I've pretty much taken on her plan, which I think is pretty brilliant. And she considers that plants naturally pass through five stages. And that is root, leaf, blossom, fruit, and then seed. And she feels the plant wishes to realize itself in the soil and for the soil to get to realize itself right along with the plant. So basically her crop rotation succession reflects that exact flow. So I'll start with something like radishes or beets, which I grow quite a bit of in the garden, turnips. Then I move on to a leafy plant like lettuce or kale. Mm-hmm. Moving forward then to a flowering plant, which I have to admit I kind of cheat a little bit and I go for beans, because beans flower and then they fruit. So they kind of do both. But they also tend to feed the soil, which is kind of a more traditional approach to crop rotation, which is plant your heaviest feeder and then a medium feeder and then a light feeder, cover crop, rejuvenate the soil, and back into your heavy feeders again. So I try to go on that flow. It seems to work out pretty good for me. It helps me keep track of it nicely because I don't have to actually draw out plans for any more of an elaborate design on it, because I can see, oh, beets are growing now. Oh, I guess I'll get ready to plant the lettuce. Or, you know, it's all very obvious because it's kind of right there. And I think the consideration of the plant realizing itself that way is just really brilliant. You know, as we know from sprouting all the seeds, the first thing that happens is the root.
One thing I haven't considered is sort of the great situation you're in as an organic start grower, that when it's time to plant the next rotation in your garden, you always have a fleet of amazing plants that are just bursting, me, yeah, plant me in the garden.
Yes, but like all considerate growers, those get to go out first into the public, and yeah, they wind up in my garden about 3 weeks later. But that's okay. They come around, and yeah, and there are times where I go, you know, shopping in the greenhouse, and it's pretty nice,
yeah,
too. I'm
awesome.
Lucky.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I was fortunate to speak, too, with a couple of exquisite growers here on Kauai and get some tips from them. I'll start out with Son Hadley of One Song Farm. They're doing a nice rotation there. He starts with chards and beet. Again, very similar to what you had described, Robin, starting out with something that is a heavy feeder. I should precede it by saying they start the process by composting and amending the soil, and they make some beautiful compost there at One Song Farm. With chards and beets, this can be a longer-term harvest, and so he's mindful to make sure to space the plants out accordingly to give them root room. And knowledgeable or mindful, too, of the fact that these chards and beets or kenopodiums need salt. And so for home compost, people who are composting kitchen scraps, it's important to remember that if you're putting food,
cooked food,
yeah, that you didn't get to or whatever, you're adding salt. And so that's something to consider. He'll follow up the chards and beets with brassica. It has less, or other things that are not as susceptible to nematodes. And nematodes really are one of the biggest problems we have here. And just to say, too, that we will be getting to pest problems solved a little bit deeper in on the brassicas next week with Dr. Scott Nelson, so tune in next week for that. You may need to add some available phosphorus at that point. And then he goes to the lettuce, radish, cilantro, turnip, arugula. These all crops that are more nematode susceptible, but he's preceded it with a brassica. And then he'll potentially follow it with another brassica, and he reminds us, too, that onions don't get nematodes at all. So even for someone who is keeping many other pests and diseases at bay, the nematodes are a consistent consideration for us and are one of the main reasons why crop rotation are so important.
Correct, I think it's the alliums, also the onions, yeah, and those related plants that they actually repel nematodes. Not only are they not susceptible, but they, right, and they are great balance for brassicas in the soil also.
Right. Sun did remind me that it is difficult if you only have one row that you have in your backyard or something like that. It's hard to achieve it on a smaller scale, but a lot of it is just observing what's going on and, you know, pull up those plant roots on a plant that might be more nematode susceptible if they're not looking healthy, and determine whether you do have that problem. in his experience, rotating in with a marigold or other nematode suppressor other than onion has not been as successful as sort of advertised claims, if you will, but I think that it's worth continuing to try with various other nematode limiting plants, like perhaps Sudan grass. Sun hemp is supposed to be nematode fighting as well. But we'll get into some more of those details.
On that exact note, you know, we talk about, we had Laura Kelly from the county recycling facility come on and talk to us about the composters, and we were so thrilled that the county now allows residents to get two composters instead of one,
yes,
which was so limiting because you can never really give it a chance to rest when you're continuously adding. And so I thought that notion of just to our listeners thinking, well, maybe we'll dig up another small garden so you have actually two working, just in the same way as the composter, that you can be bouncing back and forth, mm-hmm, between two small areas. Now, garden placement's important, sunshine, less root competition from things that are growing around it, particularly in a backyard situation. Mm-hmm. You have to consider the possibility of that. But I would look into it. There may be a different part of the yard that would be equally good, and then you could kind of bounce crops back and forth between them.
Excellent.
And
excellent
you're limited
idea.
To a small space.
Excellent idea. I also want to be mindful to mention Lisa. Well, I spoke with Sun today, Sun and Lisa, the team, and every time I go out there, she is out there working the soil and doing an exquisite job. I was also fortunate to speak with Scott Pomeroy of Nectar Gardens just before the show, and
he shared
his cover crop rotation with us. Starts out with a cover crop and fertilizing the soil. For cover crop, he's using generally Sudan grass, and also he'll grow Sudan grass, and then he will follow it with a legume, perhaps a cowpea or similar sun hemp. He doesn't grow them together, and he will grow his cover crop for 6 months to a year. So that really is a long period of time to allow some of the pests and disease problems to come down to manageable levels. After that, he'll grow a leafy green cycle, and then he'll go into a root crop, beets, carrots, turnips. He'll follow that with a legume, beans or peas. Of course, that's a nitrogen fixer, which is going to replenish the soil. Now, depending on soil quality after that cycle, if it's still looking good, feeling good, he may follow it up with another green leafy, and then he goes back into the cover crop. So cover crops we'll cover in more detail in an upcoming show, but it's definitely considered an important part of a crop rotation plan. So some of the other thoughts that we may want to consider, cycling between deep rooting and shallow rooting crops. It's important to continue to break up that subsoil with some deep rooting crops. And grasses, again, a great reason for growing a Sudan grass as part of a cover crop and a crop rotation strategy is because it's breaking up that soil at the deeper level. You want to also alternate between crops with high and low nitrogen needs, which was spoken to, Robin, with your rotation as well as Sun's. And we want to as well consider, don't follow one crop with another closely related species. And that was borne out in all three crop rotations that were described. And from an excerpt from the Market Vegetable Gardens Planning for Success, another fine publication that can be gotten online, their crop rotation was based on families and geared toward temperate situations. They really talk about year rotations, but interesting, of course, that doesn't apply to us so much, but interesting to consider the families that they lump together for crop rotations. Those would be Aliaceae, as you said again, the onions, followed by Apiaceae, carrots, celery, parsnips, parsley, followed by the Kenopodiaceae, the beets, chard, spinach, then Cucurbitaceae, cucumbers, squash, Fabiaceae, beans, and peas, Solanaceae, tomatoes, peppers, and eggplant, Asteraceae, lettuce, endive, as well as sunflower and many other fine friends in there. And then the crucifere or brassicaceae, the cabbages, broccoli, cauliflower, and on and on. So as we consider these major plant families' potential rotations, we really could see that even in Hawaii, if we followed through with these rotations, it could be quite a while until the next time kale showed up in the same bed if we had enough space, and that certainly would limit our problems with pest and disease.
Indeed. Wow, that's a lot to think about right there.
So, it's complicated. It's simple. Give it a shot. Try it out. Companion planting, although benefits are to be had in that way, are not giving us those benefits of excluding a particular crop. So I think, again, gardeners are more likely to be planting everything at once, or because of either a perceived benefit to companion planting or just because the space is small. But it may be a better option, especially because of the challenges we have here in the subtropics, to maybe just grow a rotation and extend over the garden fence and consider working with your neighbors who may have their own backyard gardens and maybe take turns at growing different kinds of crops.
That's a great
idea. Share the bounty and share the meals.
Well, before we move on to announcements, I want to address a caller question who asked if we could talk about planting and seeding days for the rest of the month. And actually, I'm going to say that we're going to just take that week by week. So each week when we do the celestial session at the very beginning of the show, we're generally giving, starting today, the next week's perfect planting schedule, and we will continue to do that. So caller, please stay tuned each week, and you'll hear about all of the best times to be planting this or that different kinds of vegetables and fruits in our gardens.
Right on. So, Robin, as far as announcements go, I was very excited to speak with you yesterday and learn that you are going to be heading down to the county courthouse tomorrow, bright and early tomorrow morning, not only to be present, but that you're going to bring some refreshments potentially.
Yes, but I'll leave that just like that. And I am. I would like to announce I got to go to the homegrown on Sunday. Willie Judah, thank you, brother. You really lit us up that day. We're really feeling it. Every single person, actually, especially starting with your set, was just really great. And I think you really brought the people together. The whole day was really about joining together, and it was really medicine. And so I want to invite our listeners, if you have your viewpoint about Bill 2491 and you want it to be heard, sounds like tomorrow's the day. It's a big decision day. We'd love to see lots and lots of our Ohana out there just making our presence known, speaking our truth, and encouraging our council to veto the mayor's veto.
Override the veto. Think the way they're saying
that's
it,
how they say it. Okay, great. Anyway, come on down. It's
not that we're calling anybody to come down, but if you came down, we'd see you and we'd probably have a great big smile on our face.
Exactly. Mahalo.
So yes, the historic override of the veto 2491, override of the veto of 2491. Scheduled for tomorrow. All fingers crossed and hopes raised for that. We want to let people know as well that the 2013 Garden Island Range and Food Festival is coming up this Sunday, November 17th, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Kilohana Luau, down on the south side. And I wanted to share, I really appreciated, not only is this a fun festive event, but I think the goals that are spoken to on the website for the food festival really are the values that we're hoping to have promoted here. Promoting careers in agriculture, encouraging growth in the production of produce and forage meats, creating strong relationships between the producers and the chefs, many more brilliant things that I think are really coming to coming to be because of the Range and Food Festival now, maybe in its fourth year or fifth year, it's really been rolling on. We want to let people know, too, about the third Saturday work party coming up at the Kalihiwai Food Forest this Saturday. We're going to be evolving our chop-and-drop methodology and transforming the space in a really huge way. Please consider joining us for that. It's going to be from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. And if you want more information, you can check out the Kauai Food Forest on Facebook or give me a call, 652-4118. And want to let people know, please stay tuned for Kauai Vibrations coming up at the top of the hour. And Robin, can you give us our outro?
Absolutely. This has been In the Garden and on the Farm with your hosts, Paul and Robin. We'd like to thank our guest on the show today, Alima Fryer. You can reach out to Alima and give her a phone call at 482-4926 to find out more information about her upcoming microgreens class and her microgreens book. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life.